This is Psych 101. We're here to make psychology understandable, entertaining, enlightening, and informative, with tips for creating a healthier state of mind for you, your family, and your friends. And I want to start off today's segment with just having a heartfelt shout out to the people in Moore, Oklahoma, and the tragedy that they have just endured. And it was incredible that only 24 people died, and there was just a few injuries and a few deaths. It was just incredible. And, you know, it just is a reminder to all of us of the resiliency that humankind has in the face of nature. So it just amazes me how the whole community is pulling together and the Red Cross is there. So if you can, make a donation to the Red Cross and do anything that you can to help. Okay, tonight I would like to, I'm having one of my friends come on. He's doing a documentary and his name is Lee Godden. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about him. He is a producer and director of Where's My Food, which we're going to be discussing for this evening, and is a soon-to-be-released documentary that reveals the social, economic, and psychological aspects of the food service. Lee founded Telsius Productions LLC in 2002, and since then, the company has built a proven track record of making award-winning, entertaining, socially conscious films and television programs. Lee's television program, Good Business, won an Elby Award for his hard-hitting interviews with CEOs who claimed to lead ethically profitable organizations. To help conscientious consumers and investors find socially and environmentally aware companies, Lee developed the Good Business Seal of Approval, which was endorsed by the Josephine Institute of Ethics, the Sierra Club, and the KLD Domini 400 Social Index. Lee also worked with the producers of the PBS TV program, Ethical Markets. An entrepreneur who's launched several companies, Lee has also written over 80 articles and covered stories for the Los Angeles Times and other publications. Lee's best-selling book, Zen Wise Selling, Mindful Methods to Improve Your Sales and Yourself, has been translated into four languages and is distributed worldwide. Thank you, Lee. How are you?
Julie, I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on. This should be an interesting topic. I love documentaries. And it's interesting now, with your background in business and music, what led you to make a documentary about the food industry?
As is sometimes the case, I suppose, in the lives of adults, the kids made me do it. I have two daughters, now 28 and 27. In the years when they were working their way through college, they served food. They waited tables at different restaurants, different types of restaurants. And they would bring home stories, sometimes good news stories, about how much they made that night, how much they tipped out. But other days, it was not so good. Sexual harassment type of things. The manager grabbed their butts or just made remarks and made them feel very, very uncomfortable. So I just kind of let this stew a little bit. I did some research, and I was actually searching for a topic for a documentary that hadn't been covered before. And lo and behold, this kind of fell in my lap. I found out that there are lots of documentaries about food, but really none about food service.
Right. And the whole thing, too, I think as Americans, we're eating out at restaurants more and more because we're busier. We don't have time to sit and make meals at home like we used to anymore. So, you know, just the whole industry and the sociological aspects behind it and the psychology behind how the business runs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, your first point is extremely right on target. We are eating out a lot. By we, of course, I'm talking about Americans. The percentage of people who make their food completely from scratch at home for every meal every day is down to the single digits. So whether that be fast food eating out or what they call quick serve, you know, the Chipotles or the fine dining experience. and everything in between, we're eating out more than ever. The restaurant industry is, according to their lobby group in Washington, D.C., the NRA, the National Restaurant Association, year-over-year increases in revenues and profits. So it's this is the time for Americans to be eating out. We're doing it quite a bit.
And probably people don't think twice about what goes behind the food that they're eating. They just sit down and they claim, like your movie's title, "Where's My Food? Serve Me Now."
That's so true. You know, there has been a lot of customer-driven change in the restaurant industry. And I'll start out by talking about the menu changes. Americans are demanding healthier food. And so with that comes better food choices, better drink choices, free-range chicken being served, and grain-fed beef, and organic wines served at the table. And hopefully this documentary, "Where's My Food?" is going to help change the other side of that, which is the consumer-driven sentiment, raising awareness of the struggles and the successes or the lifestyles of the servers who bring these dishes to our table. And I think once consumers understand some of these issues, they will demand change, and the industry will respond likewise.
Well, hopefully, because it's the food industry is a very difficult industry to, first of all, get into and then sustain. I watch the Food Network a lot, and a lot of the restaurant owners have a difficult time, especially employing quality people, and you know, people who are servers that, you know, they're the face of the restaurant, basically. So, you know, that it is all driven by how good are your employees, correct?
That's right. I mean, the servers are the face of the establishment. So you're greeted by a host or hostess, or you're seated at a table. Hopefully you're greeted by a smiling server who engages with you, perhaps asks how you're doing, gets something to drink, and after the welcomes are all done, explains what's good and fresh that day, and takes your order and brings it, and pays attention to your needs. Thanks you for coming in, and with a full belly, you smile and leave, and hopefully leave a nice tip. So, that's right. There are a lot of people working in the food industry. To be specific, 10% of all Americans work in the food industry, believe it or not. That's a huge percentage. And of those, you're talking about one-fifth of those workers are waiters and waitresses. The rest are behind the scenes. These are the cooks and the busboys so forth. So this movie doesn't touch so much on those, but a little bit. The focus of the movie is strictly on waiters and waitresses for the most part.
Okay, so for now, how long is the documentary? How many minutes?
It's going to run about 88 to 90 minutes when the final cut is done. We're in full blown editing mode right now, so most of the shooting is done, and we're looking for what they call a standard length, standard runtime, which is about 90 minutes.
And then, when are you projecting that it will be completed?
We're probably looking at entering the festival market by the end of this year, and for general release by spring of 2014.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit about the documentary, about why you focused mainly on the serving staff and all the aspects that go behind that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, we see waiters and waitresses so much, so often, that we think we know what it is they do. And if you are a server or have been a server, then you do know. So you understand what's going on. But a lot of people really make a lot of assumptions, and that's where they can be mistaken. So really the first thing to know is about the facts. What are the facts about this occupation? And you can learn a lot from, we mentioned it before, the NRA, not the gun lobby, but the National Restaurant Association, equally powerful force. And they are the proponents of restaurant owners in Washington, D.C. And, boy, they have a lot of power. They have a lot of power. So much, in fact, that when Herman Cain, the former presidential candidate, was running the National Restaurant Association, he successfully lobbied Congress to permanently cap the hourly wage of tipped workers, like restaurant workers, at $2.13 an hour federally.
Incredible, really. Who can live on $2.13 in this country? I mean, and you take out the tips from that there's a whole slew of problems right there.
That's right. And more progressive states, of course, they've enacted legislation that is that gives all workers, tipped or non-tipped, a much better, more fair, but still quite low hourly wage. California, for example, is $8 an hour. I think the federal minimum wage for all workers is $7.25. But yeah, so that's how powerful the restaurant lobby is in D.C. So with power comes problems sometimes. That's where the movie comes in. We want to kind of unveil some of these truths. We talked about how many people work in the restaurant industry, and that's about 13 million Americans, but one-tenth of the workforce. For half of us, we have worked in a restaurant. And for a third of us, of all Americans, that was our first job,
right,
in a restaurant.
That's my first job.
It was mine.
Yes.
Yeah, Baskin Robbins was my first job.
Yeah, Burger King. I smelled like dead burgers every night. Yes.
there you go. So facts will dissipate a lot of assumptions, and one of the assumptions that people have is that servers do just fine. You know, they get an hourly wage and they get tips, and they probably don't pay their taxes on their tips, which of course is wrong. One fact is that servers, that is, millions of them, live below the poverty level, below the federal guidelines for what is living in poverty. So oftentimes, the people who bring us our food in restaurants, they go home to a house that is not very nice, and they and their family often go hungry themselves. It's something we don't think about. They typically have no health insurance. They typically have no paid sick days. So when they are sick, when a server gets sick, they will come into work. Why? Because that's the way the system has set it up. If they don't go to work, they don't get paid. If they have a cold or the flu that lasts for 5 days, they are going to lose a lot of money by not coming into work.
And then they're going to pass the germs on to the consumer.
It happens all the time. It
yes.
actually happens all the time, Julia. The norovirus was a big story last year or so. There was a restaurant, I think it was back east, that was just passing around this norovirus, which is a very nasty bug. And, that was all started, in the kitchen. Worker had to come in sick. There's really no choice in the matter. So when these facts are raised to people's level of awareness, I think that's going to spur some positive change. And really, that's what the movie's all about. I don't want to paint a completely negative picture. This is a voluntary occupation, isn't it? I mean, nobody's forcing you to stay as a in your current job. Anybody in America is free to move from job to job. And some skilled fine dining servers actually do make a very nice income, very nice middle-class income, enabling them to buy a house and a car. But most servers, of course, don't have those types of fine dining jobs. Most servers work for the Red Lobsters, the Denny's, the Olive Gardens, the Applebee's, the Macaroni Grills, and so forth. And if you average all servers paid together, including tips, across America, it's about $10 an hour, just under $10 an hour. If you multiply that times 40 hours a week, which no server works 40 hours a week, very seldom, you get about $20,800 a year, and that's not much money.
Right, and you especially can't live on that kind of a wage when you're living in California. That's a near impossibility. We've got a different standard of poverty here, but it's probably higher than the than the national average, just because it costs so much to be living here in many of the areas. So you have to take that into consideration. Can you tell us about one or two of the more interesting people that you interviewed for your documentary?
Yeah, we've been lucky enough to have some great waiters and waitresses that have agreed to be interviewed. Of course, when we put the call out, so to speak, we were flooded with people who wanted their story told, but we had to be very selective because we just can't introduce that many characters into a 90-minute piece. So we have a number of very interesting stories from servers that represent a broad spectrum, from the low end of the income chain to the high end, people who have really suffered economically and people who are thriving as servers. So we're trying to be as objective as possible. We've also had some great, super experts who've agreed to be interviewed for the documentary. And Professor Michael Lynn from Cornell University, he's probably America's foremost expert in research of tipping, why we tip, and the socioeconomic and psychological aspects of tipping. We had an activist lawyer sit down with us, Saru Jayaraman, who just wrote a wonderful book, Behind the Kitchen Door, which really exposes some nastiness about the industry. And we have an executive chef and restaurant owner, Chef Schaefer from here in Los Angeles, who sat down with us. And he's an example of somebody running a great restaurant. And his servers stay with him for 15, 20 years. People in the back of the house, the cooks, the bussers, they stay with him for a long time. Why? Because he's doing it right. So we try to have a really objective approach to this film. Going back to Professor Lynn from Cornell for a moment, he spent his entire career, he's a former server himself, he waited tables on his path through graduate school, and he really digs in deep into why we tip. One of the most interesting things that he came up with through his research is that you think that tips are purely a reflection of the quality of the service, and it's really not. It's if somebody gives you great service, they'll end up getting tipped a little bit more. But it's really not this wide variance. There are so many other factors that go into how much people decide to tip at the end of a meal, and very little of that is actual service quality. So that was a real eye-opener for us.
I bet. So the psychology behind tipping. Now, did Dr. Lynn get into that in any kind of detail for this?
Yeah, he really did, and I guess one cornerstone comment that he made is the primary reason that people tip is to avoid disapproval from the server. It's staying within the norm. In other words, doing what's right, and we as humans are really driven by doing what is expected of us. And it is expected that consumers will tip after a meal. If you think about it, it's completely voluntary, correct? I mean,
right.
you finish your meal, and you have a full belly, and, oh, that's great. And that steak was $19. Great. You could actually pay that and leave if you wanted to. But people don't, by and large. But what they do is they vary tremendously on the amount of tip they leave. We did some MOS interviews, man-on-the-street interviews, where we just interviewed random people all day long asking how much they tip and so forth. And, wow, the range of responses we got was just amazing. And, of course, the norm, the social norm of tipping in America is between 15 and 20%. And hopefully those who appreciate servers, tip more than that. But Professor Lynn points out that a lot of people, including some demographic groups, do not know of the standard tipping norm. Therefore, those demographic groups tip far less. Therefore, observers tend to not appreciate waiting on those demographic groups. And it's a vicious cycle that goes around and around. And, of course, Professor Lin advocates just educational campaigns, and he's helped launch a couple of those in areas across America, and it's working. When people know what's expected of them, they will tend to tip with the norm.
Right, and I think one of the things, too, is that I've gone to some restaurants, and they have stated on the bottom, this is what the gratuity is, 15% to 20%, period, just to remind people sometimes, because you're right. I mean, there are different demographics that have different rules on that. And then, of course, there are people that come in here from other countries where they don't tip at all because they think it's just, you know, I don't know how exactly they work it out economically in other countries with paying their servers. But when I went overseas, I put a tip down, and I had people looking at me like, "What are you doing? You don't tip here," you know? Because you're right. For America, it is we're almost socially conditioned into tipping, and under certain conditions, you're right. I mean, it is, you know, kind of a social norm to a certain degree, but I, you know, this is great that you're coming out with "Where's My Food" to kind of let people know, okay, this is what you probably should be doing, or, you know, realize that, you know, being a server is really a tough job, especially if, you know, the server is serving a tough crowd of people, you know, or they're abusive to them. When I was a waitress, I had that happen to me. I was working in Wisconsin at a truck stop, and yeah, that was a short run of being a waitress. Let's put it that way.
I can just imagine, and gender definitely plays a role. It cuts both ways, positive and negatively. An attractive younger female server will, according to all research done, will make more in tips. And I guess you could listen to that fact and just go, "Well, duh, of course." But it's interesting, isn't it, that the same level of service can be delivered by, say, an older male, and that older male will receive, on average, less tip than a younger female. Women tend to tip male servers a little bit better than they do female servers, and female customers tend to tip male servers more. So kind of interesting. You mentioned it's a difficult job, and that's just no exaggeration. You're carrying hot plates on your arm. They're stacked up, weighing quite a bit. I've talked to servers who have cuts. They have leathery skin. They have injuries that they've had to just go to the emergency room and take care of. And some issues become chronic. Some chronic pain. It is not an easy job. You're on your feet. We talked to one young lady who has been serving for, about 14, 15 years. She talks about not being able to take a bathroom break. Really not so much the management says she couldn't, but just the load of tables that she had, and if she were to take a break, you know, things would fall apart. And so as a result, she's suffered from recurrent kidney infections. So a lot of things that the people aren't aware of.
Right, and again, I think the general public is unaware about what that wait staff is going through, unless they've been on that side too, and they realize, okay, well, maybe they're having a bad day instead of, wow, you know, that waitress was really a bitch to me, and, you know, I'm not going to tip her at all, because, you know, they come in with an attitude of serve me, and it's me, and I'm hungry now, and, you know, so it's difficult for the wait staff to have to deal with customers psychologically and have to figure out, okay, where are they coming from? Because I want the best tip that they can give me. But on the other end, the customer wants to be satisfied. They want to go away feeling good too, because if the customer is satisfied, then they'll come back, and hopefully word of mouth, they will return with more people and business will start thriving.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and you pegged it 100%. Servers have to be, I suppose you could say, amateur psychologists. They have to be able to read an individual, read a couple, read a table. Some people are just high maintenance, and they're going to want iced tea refills every 4 minutes, and they want somebody hovering. Other situations, just the opposite. You see a man or woman come in and engage in a relatively heavy conversation. Maybe you shouldn't pop over there so often and ask how's everything tasting, because you know something's happening at that table. So you really have to be able to read body language, nonverbal communication, eye contact or lack thereof. We had one young man, Mark. He actually is a server at a large chain restaurant, and he says what really gets him is when he goes up to a table with his biggest smile, and he says, "Hey, how you doing today?" And the answer is Sprite. The answer is Sprite. He's trying to engage. He's trying to say hello. He's trying to make them happy and make their experience a good one. And you know the result. Sometimes even with no eye contact, just you know head down towards the table, maybe clicking their cell phone. Sprite, Diet Coke. The young man I'm speaking about, he's been suffering with HIV for a number of years, paying for his own meds, going on government trial programs to get the medication cocktail he has to take every morning. He'll wake up feeling pretty bad on many mornings, but he puts on that apron, goes to work, and again tries to make everyone feel good. But his little pet peeve is when people don't even look up to him when he says hello.
Yeah, and under those circumstances, too, I know just being able to get up and get out of bed and have to fake feeling good and then have to go and serve people who want it now and feel that they're obligated to have good service every time. That's got to be really difficult. And to get no kind of human warmth from the customer has got to be disheartening.
It really does. It really does. We had twin sisters, believe it or not, interviewed for the film. Mariel and Natalie, both 29. They came from, their mom had a career as a server, but really struggled personally. You know, a lot of alcoholism in the family. So these two girls, really to survive, to get a hot meal, started serving at age 15, these two twins. And one of them went in the corporate route, and the other one went the independent route. But they're both full-time professional servers. Amazing. One of the twins, Mariel, is a young mother, and she says when she's when she's been pregnant and serving before, when she's showing, when her belly's very large, it's great because it's kind of a conversation starter with tables and, oh, hey, look at you, when's the baby due and everything, which is the worst part of being a pregnant server is during those months when you're really not showing that much and you are feeling horrible. You wake up that morning and, maybe throw up in the morning and maybe you're throwing up during the day and you're just feeling really bad. But, hey, you've got to pay the rent. You've got to work. And she says really that's when she sees, a lot of the worst in people because she's feeling pretty green around the gills. Mm-hmm. And people are, hey, where's this? Where's that? I really did get to feel a lot of pain during these interviews. But then again, there's a lot of good stories, too. We've talked to professional career servers who are doing really well. We had one young man, young by my standards. He's 35. He's actually a Los Angeles school teacher on a part-time basis. But to supplement his income, he serves food. And he actually makes much more money serving food than he does from the county as a teacher. So some great stories also.
Yeah, although that's quite the statement. I make more money as a waiter than I do a teacher. That I had to go and to school for and pay student loans, and now I'm making more as being a waiter. That's quite a statement on what's happening in our society right now, isn't it?
It really is, and this server Jack is his name, 35 years old. Of course, he does work in a fine dining establishment, and sometimes people will say, "So, you know, what are you going to do with your life? What are you doing?" He says, "Well, I'm doing it." And they said, "You know, you should probably go to school or something." And he's, I did go to school. I have a degree. Well, what are you going to do with that? Well, I became a teacher. Well, what are you doing here? I'm making more money here. What other questions can I answer for you? So, a lot of people really think it's a pass through type of profession. You know, it's something that young people do on their way to getting a degree or hoping for that big break in Hollywood or whatnot. And sure, that's certainly a percentage.
John Hamm.
That's right. That's right. But there are a lot of full-time professional servers who approach it, I will say, in the European way, which is to say that, in a lot of European countries, being a waiter is considered a position that you become an apprentice and then a senior apprentice, and you get more responsibility, and then you become a full practitioner and a journeyman, and it's a very honored profession. You don't see that too much over here in the States.
No, that is a very different way of approaching it. I never knew that.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
What's one of the darkest sides of the restaurant industry that you've run into making this documentary?
Well, you know, the dark side really came to light when we interviewed Saru Jayaraman, who wrote the book Behind the Kitchen Door. We interviewed her just an hour or two before she was on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher television show. Her book is doing very well. She really is spending her life, her career, fighting for the rights of servers, restaurant workers, I should say, some of whom are servers, but many of whom, perhaps most of whom, are actually the back of the house staff. And the way she describes it is there is rampant wage theft, sexism, racism, and of course, as we know, for pretty much all restaurant workers, just no health insurance or paid sick days. Some very dark stories from there, and she talks about the line between poverty level wages and the just really driven a lot of the restaurant employee community to food stamps and other government-funded assistance programs. And so she's lobbying, she's speaking, she's urging not just the government, but customers. She's urging customers to check which restaurants treat their workers well, not just to serve good food, that's important, but through her website, which is ROC, the Restaurant Opportunity Center website, she actually will give you a rating, 1-star to 5-star of a restaurant. If you check it out, there's even a cell phone app for it. And before you choose on a restaurant for the evening, you say, well, does this place really treat their employees well? And if they do, patronize it and vote with your pocketbook, so to speak.
That's a wonderful way to approach it. That would be great. I hope she succeeds with that. I think that would really start, you know, revolutionizing the industry, making some changes where they need to be made. So it's not, you know, so it's not an overall abusive industry to be working for, because there's not only the psychological and physical well-being of the employees that need to be taken into consideration, but also us as consumers as to what is coming out on that plate, whether it's sanitary and it's safe and, you know, it was made with good energy, I guess you could say.
That's right. And she talks about the darker your skin, the further back in the kitchen you're likely to work, based on pure research. It's all documented. She's surveyed lots of workers, and of course, the better looking, certainly better spoken employees tend to be those in the front of the house serving the food. And as your skin gets darker and your English gets worse, you'll be in the back. That may be somewhat expected, but the disappointing part is that if you really improve yourself in the back of the house, you work on your English, and you want that chance for promotion, for advancement. You want to become a server. You want to make some more money. Those opportunities are really not offered. And again, you may look at that perhaps callously and say, well, wait, just move on to someplace else. But it's not really that easy. If you spent 5 years washing dishes in the back of the kitchen, you can't just go next door and say, hire me, at the same wage. So that's what she's fighting for, and I think it's worthy of our encouragement and support.
So during your research, did you come across some of the reasons why people stay within the food industry when it's low paying and it's long hours and all these other obstacles to have to go through?
Well, they either will approach it as a profession where they become very skilled and they learn their wines and they learn how to communicate, how to read people, and they thrive. They do very well. And so in that case, a lot of these workers, they will work less than 40 hours a week. They have lots of free time, and they make decent money, and they love it. So that's really, I suppose, the best reason to serve and to keep serving food for a living is because you figured it out, you do very well at it. But the other aspect is it's a bit of an addictive type of thing, isn't it? If you come to work every day, it's almost like going to Las Vegas every day and rolling the dice and saying, come on, lucky seven or whatever the lucky dice number is. Because you don't know how much at the end of that shift, at the end of that evening, you will walk away from. And usually you walk away with cash tips. That's how you tip out, with cash for the most part. And so it can range, and it's a wild range. It can be maybe $30 or $40 in a kind of a common restaurant like a BJ's Pizzeria, for example. Low tip out amount would be $30 to $40. High tip out amount would be around $100. In higher end restaurants, you can the low tip out amount may be around $80. The high would be around $300 to $400. So it really varies tremendously. And so, again, it's like going to Las Vegas every day. Who wants to go to Las Vegas every day? Well, risk takers do. And perhaps people who have that addiction to thrill, the thrill seekers. So, when you throw that into the mix, what else comes along with it? Well, a lot of these, a lot of servers have alcohol addiction issues. 17 to 18% of all servers use or abuse drugs on a regular basis. It's the good with the bad. If you're into that lifestyle, you really have to tell yourself, I'm not going to party. If at the end of your shift, if you have cash in your pocket, you need to go home and put it in the rent jar. But a lot of servers don't do that. They struggle because they go out with their friends drinking until 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, come in the next day around 11 o'clock to set up for lunch, still have alcohol in their breath, and they have no money in their pocket, and their rent is late.
Yeah, so, I know. I've definitely worked with servers that were in that mold, and that was real interesting because it is. I mean, it's the lure of having cash when you get done at the end of the day. It's like, all right, let's go celebrate, let's go party. So right. Yeah, right. That was pretty typical. And I was a bartender for a while too, so it's just, but the party was always there, so what do you do, right? Well, and the party was there and you had the cash on hand.
That's a real key point, is that, you're serving food and beverage, oftentimes alcoholic beverages, to your customers. You are around alcohol and around partying, woohoo, living it up type customers. This is your work. And sometimes you get a little bit too absorbed in that, and you'll take a few drinks and you'll start to say, hey, I'm just like my customers. I'm living the high life. But you're not just like your customers. Your customers are in there spending their money. They're typically salaried people, and they've got a budget. You've got to be very careful. And I found that the more successful lifetime servers who are very content with the profession are those that really have found a way to, like I said, go home, bank the money, and just go to work the next day without partying in between.
Yeah, and that might be just a few people. Did you find that in your research?
I believe you're right. It doesn't seem to be the majority. The people who've survived for decades, and when we interviewed several people who've been doing this for their entire adult lives, the ones who are doing it successfully, and again, paying for the car, paying for the house or the apartment with no problems, they know how to do it. They approach it with a very steady mindset, very disciplined, if you will. The ones who are struggling, they just haven't gotten the message yet for whatever reason.
Interesting. Okay, I want to take this time for a moment to let our listeners know, if you would like to download this program, we are on iTunes. All you need to do is go there and type in Psych 1-on-1, and that's PSYCH, the number 1-O-N, and another number 1. We also have about 7 or 8 other previous programs that you can go to and download too. And every week we go through a different theme. I talk to different experts and try to really dive into the everyday psychology of life, because there's so much going on right now. So Lee, can you tell us a little bit about your book? That sounded really interesting.
The book, Zen Why Selling? Yeah, that was
yes.
9 or 10 years ago. Is that what you're asking about, Julie?
I am.
Yeah. It's as a philosophical Zen practitioner, not a religious Zen Buddhist approach so much as just a science of the mind, kind of be quiet and listen and be who you're with intently and stop the mind from wandering approach. I just decided to apply that to my profession at the time, which was sales. I was a high-tech sales executive selling expensive computer networking components into large accounts. And then managing teams of people who did that. So I had a few coworkers who said, "Lee, hey Zen boy, why don't you write a book?" And so I did, and it got some traction. It got up to, I think, number 11 on Amazon's list at one point. It was in all the bookstores, translated into several languages, and put me on a little bit of a speaking circuit, which was tremendous fun. Imagine making a room full of executives close their eyes and meditate on the edge of their chairs for a couple of minutes.
And actually breathe.
And actually breathe. That's right. So, that was a lot of fun. Zen Why Selling. It's still for sale on Amazon if somebody wants to check it out.
Okay, so can you let the listeners know how they can order that?
Yeah, the book is just go to Amazon.com and type in Zenwise, which is Zenwise, Zenwise Selling, or probably just Zenwise will pick it up. And it's Lee Godden is the author, and there you have it. If you like, I can also mention the website for the documentary.
Yes.
Yeah, it's wheresmyfood.com, just the way it's spelled, www.wheresmyfood.com. There's a Facebook page, facebook.com/wheresmyfood, and we encourage people to visit the site. There's a page where you can sign up for updates and to follow the progress of the documentary. And, of course, we love it when people like the page on Facebook. We have a large mailing list now, and we certainly would encourage that to grow. So if you want to be part of the community following this film until its release and possibly receiving some invitations to a local film premiere of the documentary, then please go to the website, and we'll take care of you.
Okay, and would you... there's also an email address. Would you like to mention that and the phone number?
Sure. If people want to reach out to me directly, that's just Lee, L-E-E, at wheresmyfood.com. Lee at wheresmyfood.com. And I respond, of course, to all emails personally.
Okay. Now, with so many food servers in this country, where are the unions behind all of these employees?
Yeah, it's very funny that you ask. 0.001%, and that is statistically correct, of all restaurant workers are unionized. Not 1%, 0.001%. So very, very few. You'll find it in a couple of hotel chains and convention center catering departments and so forth. But most obviously, the great majority are not unionized. What Saru Jayaraman is doing is trying to form these informal unions, if you will, through the ROC, which is her organization she founded after 9/11, which is a Restaurant Opportunities Center. And front and especially back of the house workers are encouraged to go there, and they can meet locally and start petition drives, and they've even organized boycotts of certain restaurants that have particularly heinous practices. So that's the best that's available right now for organizing workers of restaurants, I believe, is the ROC.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what kind of response your documentary is going to generate. What do you think is going to happen with it?
Well, I would like to see it take off. I'd like to see it be the center of discussion for a little while. New media event lasts for more than a blink of a cosmic eye. But if it can raise some eyebrows and create some genuine discussion, I would be delighted. I just think this is a subject that has really not been talked about very much. Again, we talk very much about food in America, and a couple on their way out to eat for dinner may say, tonight I'm only going to have the grain-fed beef and the organic wine, and that's wonderful, and that you're trying to do the right thing, trying to take the green approach to eating out, which is a wonderful thing. And so consumers are driving that. But what consumers are not driving right now is what they're not aware of, which is the working conditions and the struggles of a lot of people who work in the restaurant industry. The movie is not centered on the plight, if you will, of food servers, but it certainly touches on it because it's a real and existing condition that needs to be addressed. But objectively, we also look at the fact that this is a free country. People can change their professions, change their jobs, and a lot of people really thrive and do well as waiters and waitresses. So we try to look at the full picture, but when you look at the darker side of it, it really does need to be addressed.
So what is your main theme that you want to get across to the general public?
That you are being served by a stranger and yet a fellow human. And I think that when you look at the ethics of reciprocity in all of the world's religions, which is do unto others as you would do unto yourself, treat your neighbor as you would have them treat you, really, that permeates all the world's religions for a reason, and that is it's the right thing to do. So when you go out to eat, take a moment, take a breath, engage with your server, perhaps ask how their day is going, and enjoy the experience. Make it an experience. The reason you have a professional waiter or waitress serving you is because they are there to make your experience as joyful and delicious as possible. When you go out to eat in an establishment where there's waiters and waitresses, this is not fast food. This is not McDonald's, where you're expected to deliver your order within 60 seconds. If you really are looking for that, then maybe you should go to a McDonald's. But if you're going to an establishment where there's wait staff, just relax. Engage with the server. Eye contact is great. And I guarantee you'll walk away from that restaurant feeling not just full of good food, but full of some good human spirit as well.
Right, and you've made somebody else's day a little bit better who is not making a great wage. I think that's something that we all need to take into consideration is, again, it's really difficult work. It's really hard on a person's body and their psyche. And just to be treated as a human being instead of, you know, a scapegoat for somebody who's having a bad day is huge.
That's what makes us human, I believe. That's what separates us from everything else on this wonderful planet. So be human, be kind, and be good to your neighbors and be good to your servers.
That's great. I agree highly. So what do you want people to take away from Where's My Food?
Well, you know, follow the go to the website wheresmyfood.com. Click on the page. It says keep me informed of the progress. If people want to contribute, we are absolutely taking donations right now. Making a film of any sort requires a tremendous amount of capital, not to mention time. And I'm putting a couple of years of my life into this project because I believe in it. And we have some key investors on board, so we want to make this as good a movie as possible. So if people want to become part of it from a production point of view, then we really encourage them. There's a donation page on the website. And, of course, every donation receives a special gift. So if it's a smallish donation, you'll get a Where's My Food pen. If it's a larger donation, you'll get a movie poster and DVD and so forth, and front row tickets to the premiere as the levels go up. So if people are interested in becoming part of it, I really encourage them to reach out to me directly or through the website, and that's really it. It's just an engagement campaign. It's a labor of love for me. I believe in the project, and it's I can see the end here. Like I said, we've filming is tailing off, and editing is in full steam. Editing can take a long time, and there's a lot of things to pay for in the editing process, in terms of graphics, motion graphics, transitions, and so forth. And then you have the musical score that runs through the movie. So nothing is free. So if people want to get involved, please reach out to me.
Great. And what feelings and thoughts do you want people to walk away with after they viewed this documentary?
Just a nodding of the head, which is, oh, I get it. Okay, that makes sense. A little bit more awareness will lead to a little bit more compassion, I believe. So I suppose in a nutshell, just leaving the viewing of this documentary with a greater sense of understanding and compassion for the fellow human beings who, when we're hungry, will bring us a nice plate of warm food in exchange for some cash in our pocket. It's a pretty common transaction, and I think it's one that we do a little bit brainlessly sometimes. We just we don't really think about the people who are bringing our food. If it's a family member, if it's your mother or father or grandparents bringing you a nice plate of warm food at home, you certainly think about the human being bringing that food, because that food is brought from a standpoint of love and care and familial closeness. Why does it have to be so different in restaurants? So that's really the emotional goal of the film.
So the next time you go out to eat, make it a win-win situation, and everybody walks away happy, correct?
100% correct, Julia. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Yeah, I agree. Well, we're going to wrap things up. I really want to thank Lee Godden for coming and discussing his documentary, Where's My Food? And again, that's wheresmyfood.com, correct?
That's it. Where's, like the contraction with the apostrophe in the middle, wheresmyfood.com. No apostrophe in the website address, of course. Just wheresmyfood, wheresmyfood.com. And that's it. That's how to reach me.
Great. And if any of the listeners want to contact me, give me their opinions, maybe give me some, what would you like to be hearing in future podcasts? Just, contact me. I'd love to speak to you, and that would be great. My contact is jgoode8@verizon.net. Again, that's jgoode8@verizon.net. And we're going to be keeping on pushing on with Psych 1-on-1. I'm really excited. And special thanks to Jeremy and Nick for keeping free speech alive at Skid Row Studios. Wonderful programming. Check out the other programs. We're having new programs coming on, and it's very exciting. So, What's up next is going to be the Qumran Report. Stay tuned for that. Join me every week live from Monday on at 7 to 8 p.m. Sometimes we need to do these pre-recorded, but that's okay. It works out all in the end, right? So thank you so much for listening. My name is Julianne Good. This has been Psych 1-on-1. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Bye-bye.